Welcome and good morning. First case, State of Ohio versus Fred Johnson. Ms. Gutierrez.
Chief Justice Brown, and may it please the court. My name is Lindsay Gutierrez, and I'm here today on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Fred Johnson. Your Honors, I respectfully request 2 minutes for rebuttal. The issue before this court today is a certified conflict originating between the first and fifth appellate districts regarding whether the elements of child endangering as set forth in 2919.22b1, abuse of a child, are sufficiently similar to the elements of felony murder with the predicate offense of child endangering, such that the commission of the murder logically and necessarily also results in the commission of child endangering. Very simply, Your Honors, Fred's position is that felony murder with the predicate offense of child endangering and child endangering are allied offenses of similar import, thereby resulting in one conviction and one sentence. Your Honors, before I get to the two-pronged test in Cabrales, I'd like to take a moment to address briefly why we're here today as a result of this conflict. And while I will be asking the court to resolve whether or not these two offenses are allied offenses, the reason that we are here today is because appellate courts across the state of Ohio are continuously misinterpreting and misapplying this court's ruling in Brown. And in my brief, I spend a lot of time talking about Brown because the First District Court of Appeals used its interpretation of Brown to create the conflict in this case. And, Your Honors, I acknowledge and accept that this is not an error correction court, and I'm not asking you to only correct the error of the First District Court of Appeals, but the error that the First District Court of Appeals made in this case is an error that's occurring all across the state of Ohio. It's a problem that we face every day as practitioners who practice criminal law. You see it in the sentencing courts, and you see it in the appellate courts. Allied offenses are extremely confusing, and especially when you're dealing with...
Yes, what is it about Brown that makes it confusing? It seems to me Cabrales is straightforward.
I would agree, Your Honor.
Brown was a somewhat different matter.
And I would agree, Your Honor. I noted in my brief that Brown is a very unique situation.
Right.
In that situation, there are subsections of a code section, and this court, in its decision, looked at that, and when it applied the two-prong test in Cabrales, it realized the General Assembly could not have intended, you know, for separate cumulative punishments here. However, what the Fifth District did in Morin, which the First District then followed in Fred Johnson's case, is they looked at the wording, and it was one small line in Brown. They didn't look at the whole decision of Brown. They looked at the line in Brown that said, well, our two-tiered test for determining whether offenses constitute allied offenses of similar import is helpful in construing legislative intent. It is not necessary to look at that test when the societal interests are different. I submit to this court, and the court has ruled since in Wynn and in Harris and in Williams, that that was not this court's intention. Courts, appellate courts across the state are taking that one line, and they are using that to do away with the two-prong test in Cabrales. And that is where the source of this problem first originated. The First District in this case, in relying on Morin, from the Fifth Appellate District, thought that that was better reasoning, and better reasoning being that they entirely abandoned the two-prong test in Cabrales simply with this one line that they extracted from Brown and used that to say, you
know. So they jump over to a societal test, is that?
Yes, Your Honor. That's exactly what's happening. Well, it's not in my brief. In preparing for this argument, I did look at some of the cases recently decided in the First District. A case out of the First District, State versus Klein, the First District has again relied on their analysis in Johnson that was used in the Fifth District in Morin, that when we look at societal interests and they are different, because they claim that the societal interests of child endangering and felony murder are different, that we end our analysis there. And I submit to present to this court that that was not this court's intention in Brown. Brown was a very unique situation, as I stated previously. They were subsections of, you know, one particular code section, as was the case in Harris. In Harris, it was felonious assault. And
counsel, as the concurring opinion pointed out, that societal interest was not part of a syllabus statement, and we know now that the syllabus is not where the law is. The law is in every part of the case. But the majority did use that term and suggested that the societal interest, the General Assembly, the General Assembly's intent is to be taken into account. Now, not everyone agreed with that, but are you saying that we should ignore that language, that we should expressly disavow that language and look solely to the statute, as Cabrales and the other cases did?
No, Your Honor. What I'm asking this court to do is simply give some clarification to appellate courts that the intention in Brown was not to say you can first look at societal interests, and if they're different, your analysis ends.
So you're saying you still think that there's a point where societal interest has to play a part? Is that what you're saying?
Your Honor, I think that societal interest, which is clarified, I believe, in Wynn by this court, is one factor that can be considered when looking at the Cabrales test. And I present to this court that that was the intention, and that's what works best at the appellate courts coming from Brown, that you can consider societal interest in accordance with the two-prong test of Cabrales, but you cannot use societal interest as the ultimate deciding factor.
But that term is still a pretty amorphous term. Would you agree?
I would, Your Honor.
Do we even need Brown? I mean, if it's causing confusion, why shouldn't we just say Cabrales seems to cover it? Judge Painter here seemed to get it in one sentence.
He did, Your Honor. With Brown, I think Brown, like I said, it's very unique and it plays a small role. And I think for the role that it was intended to play, it's needed because it was used, again, as I stated in Harris, with felonious assault. When you have two subsections of the same code section, in A1 and in A2, it makes sense to use the analysis in Brown because when you take the elements of A1 and A2 and you set them side by side, there can be the argument that in the abstract, they do not account for allied offenses. However, logic and common sense tells us, as this court understood in Brown, that you shouldn't receive two sentences simply because you're charged and convicted with an A1 felonious assault or an A1 aggravated assault and an A2 aggravated assault. That could not have been the intention of the General Assembly.
So, Ms. Gutierrez, do we need a rule that says when you're considering two separate statutes, Cabrales is the case to follow, and when you're considering two forms of one statute, Brown is the case to follow? Do we have to spell it out that clearly?
Your Honor, I believe that would be very helpful for appellate courts. And I think that applies clear, applicable lines that courts can actually use. Because what we see happening now is, like I stated previously, you have appellate courts across the state that look at this language, take it out of context, that one small sentence, and they're starting, you know, they use it like they did in Mr. Johnson's case to decide that the societal interests are done. I know what result I may get with Cabrales, and I don't want that result. Therefore, I'm going to use this sentence in Brown to my advantage. And the whole point of when this court decided Cabrales and clarified Rance was to prevent shotgun convictions. It was to prevent courts from sentencing a defendant for, you know, the same act. And while Rance needed clarification in Cabrales.
Well, isn't that clearly what the legislature seems to have intended as well, to prevent that?
Of course, Your Honor, yes.
You didn't even need our cases. Plain reading of the statutes would indicate the legislature didn't intend this piling on. And doesn't the problem really go back to prosecutors who still choose to shotgun it?
I would agree, Your Honor. And when you look at the case of Mr. Johnson, he was charged and indicted for various offenses of the same conduct. In his case, it was a felonious assault as the predicate offense of a felony murder, then child endangering as the predicate offense of felony murder when there was only one act and one murder committed. And
I realize you can't put yourself in the position of prosecutors, but since you defend these, is there a strategic reason for doing that? Is there some concern that perhaps a jury won't buy one theory or approach to a case, but might buy another one, so that there's a common sense reason for using your term, shotgunning it?
Of course, Your Honor. I mean, it's well understood in our practice that prosecutors charge our clients simply because, for the reason you stated, a jury may, you know, convict them of one but not convict them of another. Basically, they're covering all the ground that they can in charging that way. And that's why I believe it's on the responsibility of this court to create case law to direct these appellate courts and the sentencing courts and give them some guidance, because in preparing for this argument, I watched oral arguments in front of this court, and you seem to be having a lot of these cases.
Is it your theory, then, that what happens at the Court of Appeals level or at the trial court level, when it comes time to winnow this down to one penalty for the singular act, say the jury has found guilt on the variety of charges that have been introduced, but it should be one sentence for the one act, that if it's really heinous in nature, then the temptation is on the trial judge and the Court of Appeals to duck over and say societal interests demand that we don't take this down to one penalty.
That would be exactly my argument, Your Honor. And that's what happened here, is they looked at this offense. I mean, it is. Factually, the facts are not good. They're difficult to read. They're difficult to consider. And that's what they did in this case. And when it first went up to the first district, Mr. Johnson actually had two murder convictions, even though there was only one victim. And they had merged the felonious assault and the first felony murder. And then when he went up to the first district, they merged those, because obviously common sense tells you with the murder of one victim, you can't be convicted and sentenced for two counts of murder. However, they didn't complete the analysis with the child endangering and the felony murder. And that's simply because they relied on the Fifth District in doing exactly what I was speaking about earlier, that it was a result-oriented conclusion. And they didn't want to sentence him, you know, to one sentence, one conviction, one sentence. So therefore, they decided, oh, societal interests, we're not even getting to the Cabrales test.
Counsel, I would like to, before your time expires, direct you to another issue that was raised, I think, in the amicus brief. And that is, there apparently is a line of cases that says the predicate offense never merges with the overall offense. Would you comment on that? Is that line of cases still good law, and how does that apply in this case?
Your Honor, I would argue that no, those line of cases that is in, I believe it's the Franklin County Prosecutor's amicus brief, is not good law. Those line of cases rely on Rantz. And while in that brief they make note that in clarifying Rantz and Cabrales, they only were discussing strict textual comparison and just looking at it in elements in the abstract. However, that line of cases where predicate offenses do not merge, you know, with the overarching offense, that came after this court's clarification since then, and recent development in the law changes that past case law. A lot of those cases are from over 10 years ago, and they do not consider this court's decisions in Wynn, in Harris, or in Williams. Most recently, when the Fifth District decided Mills, and they decided that that's the conflict case in this case, they noted that accordingly we find these cases inapplicable to the instant case based on current developments in the law. And those developments came from this court, and as I stated, in Harris and Wynn, and most recently in Williams. It's illogical and, again, beyond common sense to think that the abuse of a child that results in the murder, that one doesn't necessarily flow from the other. The commission of the murder cannot be so without the offense of the abuse of the child. And it's going to produce absurd and inconsistent results to maintain the stance that predicate offenses never merge. Because in this case, had we not had the abuse of the child, there would be no felony murder. because the abuse of the child here was the basis for the felony murder. There was no argument on the prosecutor's behalf that there were any different acts. That in, you know, one of the elements of felony murder is that there has to be a felony of the first or second degree. In this case, it just happened to be the offense of child endangering. And this court in Williams acknowledged that the attempted murder there, you know, obviously it has to flow from an offense of violence. In that case, the offense of violence just happened to be the felonious assault. The statute for attempted murder does not have to specifically lay out that the offense has to be felonious assault. And that's what that argument relies on with those prior cases with predicate offenses. The argument is that the predicate offense for felony murder could be one of nine things. And just because it happened to be child endangering here, it's not specifically laid out. But again, that defies all logic and common sense.
Just one other question, just to so I understand. I think Mr. Johnson was convicted of three counts of child endangering total.
Yes, Your Honor.
And we're here today on merging one of those three counts. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so the other two still stand then.
The court certified the conflict based on the B1. My argument would be that in accordance with this court's decision in Brown, two of the counts of child endangering, the two subsections, the B1 and the B2, would actually merge because it's a corporal punishment and abuse of the child. They obviously, the General Assembly, intended those to be one punishment.
But that isn't before us today, right?
It is not.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gutierrez. Mr. Cummings?
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices Phil Cummings from the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office. Your Honors, I'd like to start by saying, I suppose, that I think the problem we're dealing with here is reflects a tension between two competing interests. One interest is to do justice in a particular case, and another interest is to have bright-line legal rules that makes the law easy to interpret and consistently apply. That's why the prosecutor's offices, I'm sure, across the state.
Well, hasn't the legislature made it pretty clear what they intend to have happen and that our cases are just explaining that?
Well, I would look to the statute, the multi-offense statute, which actually begins with the phrase, you have to look at the defendant's conduct. And I think that's a clear indicator that the legislature wanted the defendant's conduct to be a starting place for the determination of a multi-offense analysis. And I think that that concept was embraced and applied way back under Newark versus Vazirani. And personally, I think a lot of the problems that we've all been experiencing for the past 10 years relate to State versus Rance. Prosecutors' offices loved State versus Rance because it gave us a bright line rule to follow. However, it did result in absurd results at times, and as the court struggled to do justice, the Rance standard has become modified and it's evolved to the point where courts are struggling with how to apply it appropriately, and that's
what has to be struggled with when one reads Cabrales. It seems pretty straightforward.
Well, Rance and Cabrales tell us that we are to compare the statutory elements in the abstract, and they say we are not to look at the particular indictment, we're not to look at the particular facts of the case, and that's the starting point with a Rance-Cabrales analysis. Yet as time has moved forward, the law has evolved away from that type of application of the standard. And instead of truly looking at an abstract comparison of the elements.
Well, when you say the law has evolved away, what do you mean by that?
The
legislature didn't change anything, did they?
No. I'm referring to the main cases coming out of this court over the past years. We've got Cabrales, we've got Wynn, Harris, where the court acknowledges that there is you can commit one offense without committing the other. So if you apply a strict interpretation of Rance, they are dissimilar. Yet this court has gone on to find and say that, you know, under the facts of this case or under this indictment or under this scenario, we're gonna find these merge. And I think that's what's caused the confusion over the preceding years.
Mr. Cummings, should the court begin to consider the facts that surround this rather than looking just at the statutory language in the abstract?
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice, in my humble opinion, I would ask the court to consider a return to Newark versus Vazirani, because I think that if this court clearly and consistently sends the signal out that we are going to do it. We're going to make sure justice is done in every case. And really what that comes down to is you're going to look at the defendant's conduct in each case and make sure he's appropriately convicted and punished for truly what he's culpable for. And I think that was the beauty of Newark versus Vazirani. It was also, it's what's reflected in the statutory language of the multi-count statute where it says, let's look at the defendant's conduct. I think the Rantz standard was great because it was a bright line, but it just hasn't proved workable. And I think
in this case, then, walk through the analysis if the facts and the conduct were actually considered.
In this particular case, Mr. Johnson would still be separately punished for the three counts of child endangering because in this case, it's the state's contention, as it was below, although the Court of Appeals did not find this, that Mr. Johnson committed the murder and the child endangering with a separate animus. He beat this little boy for a period of time throughout that afternoon, over and over again. It's the state's contention that clearly, with the first hit of little Milton, he committed child endangering. That's physical harm to a little boy. Now, it's a separate animus when it goes far beyond that, and he beats this little boy to the point that the boy dies. That's clearly more than necessary to commit murder. He committed child endangering way beyond what was necessary to cause the boy's death. He beat him for a long period of time. So because there's a separate animus in Mr. Johnson's case from the child endangering and the felony murder based on child endangering, it's the state's contention that these are separately punishable. There was a separate animus. And the state does embrace the concept of State versus Brown. There is a different societal interest between these two statutes. Felony murder protects all life. Child endangering statutes uniquely protect the societal interest of our most innocent and vulnerable in our society, children. So for multiple reasons, we believe a look at this case, just the facts of it, would warrant separate punishments for the child endangering and the felony murder.
Could the prosecution bring a charge for felonious assault in this case as well, in your view?
They did, and that was considered to be merged. And I think that the way the law has progressed,
why wouldn't the child endangering merge?
I would say because of the felonious assault and the murder, I think, would merge more quickly and before the child endangering and the felony murder based on that.
Help me with how quickly and closer and more. I don't understand that.
That's a good question, and those are these difficult subjective issues that are hard to deal with. But I would think that the child endangering, because it has a unique societal interest, I think warrants a separate punishment. And I think that would probably be the beginning point for distinguishing that and the felonious assault.
Felonious assault wouldn't have its own societal interest?
It does, but I think it's arguable, certainly from the defense side, that interest in protecting one against physical harm would be subsumed within the murder, too, life. And I could more easily understand the merger of those two. But I think with a child endangering, you've got a completely separate societal interest, and you've got a very innocent, vulnerable young boy who deserves a special protection of two punishments in that case.
If we promulgate a resolution or a rule that would indicate when there are two separate statutes at issue, courts should apply the Cabrales test, would that clarify this through the courts, in your view?
It would certainly help, yes. I think that the prosecutors' offices and courts of appeals have jumped on this Brown analysis because it arguably provided a whole other line of justification.
Exactly.
And I think the societal interest is a very valid concept, and I think everybody nodded their head and said, we get it. And I think that it wasn't limited in the verbiage of the opinion to just, a statute that has two variations of the same offense. I think if that had been made more clear, I don't think we would have had this particular issue in this case. Yes.
Counsel, you said something a minute ago about whether conduct deserves two punishments. And isn't that the issue here on the allied offenses? I mean, when you look at the statute, it talks about the defendant's conduct. And
yes.
The whole purpose of allied offenses is to see whether there are when juries have alternate theories and convict on more than one offense. There's criminal behavior, there's a jury trial, there's two convictions on two separate offenses. The question of allied offenses is whether those two offenses should merge so that there should be one punishment rather than two. Is that kind of where you're coming from?
I mean, yes.
Isn't this the difficulty is for the trial judge who then has to look after the verdicts are in, and let's say there are three convictions, as there were in this case, and decide what, if any, of the offenses should merge.
Yes.
So that punishment is more limited. From your point of view, I mean, the more, the better, it sounds like.
As prosecutors, we are zealously supporting and advocating for the people of the state of Ohio. So we are going to present juries with every charge that's arguably to be made. I do think it's the trial judge's duty and obligation, after the convictions have been returned by a jury, to make an assessment from the trial judge's opinion whether or not these various convictions or these various crimes were committed with a separate animus. Are they of similar import? And I think that's the trial judge's call, and he sentences or she sentences based upon that analysis.
Using the example that we've used in other cases, an individual shoots someone three separate times. In your perspective, is that three separate charges, and should they merge?
Again, I would say that is a perfect example of a question that cries out for a Newark versus Vazirani analysis. It depends upon how those three shots were fired. Were they fired in rapid succession? To me, that would indicate more of one single animus. However, if they were fired once and then 2 minutes later over here and then 3 minutes later over there, separate animus, three separate charges. And if I were the judge, that would be the way I would look at that.
But in both in your analysis, then, you're looking at the evidence that is adduced at trial.
Correct.
And that really would be an easier way for the trial judge to deal with this, as opposed to saying, okay, open your book and look at the abstract comparison of the offenses here.
I agree.
There we're talking about a similar, the same offense committed three separate times, so that's a little easier. But if we were talking attempted murder, let's say, and felonious assault, you would use that analysis.
Yes.
Look at the conduct and then make the determination.
Yes, and I say that only in retrospect, only because of the past 10 or 12 years of what's happened. But I think that in light of what has occurred, it puts the decision-making at the trial level where the facts of the case played out and where the facts of the case became known and where the conduct of the defendant was put on display. And the people that heard that testimony, the judge in the courtroom, is in the best position to understand, was there separate animus here? Was this all a series of a same activity, or was it separated in time? Are the crimes of similar import or not? And I think that this would avoid, in large part, what we've seen evolve over the past 10 or 12 years as everybody's tried to struggle to understand how best to apply Rance.
Although Rance was decided to avoid the problem of looking at facts, and the idea being that let's make a bright line that's, quote, easy, quote, to follow.
It was a great idea. We loved it. It's just an application. It produced absurd results. Of course, we concede that, and we all struggled with trying to do justice in each case. And in essence, when you start twisting Rance and getting away from it and modifying it in an effort to do justice in a particular case, what are we really doing? We're going back to an analysis of the conduct of the defendant and trying to do what's right in a given case. It's a more holistic approach. Yes.
One of the questions in Rance that appeared not to be answered was, in a case like this where you have various subsections that you could apply, for example, in this case, commit offensive violence as a felony of the first or second degree. So you've got a whole choice to choose from. If you were doing completely in the abstract, what is your view about what the state of the law is and what the law should be in terms of using that as indicted, something a little more concrete than all of the possible choices, which, of course, are always going to yield a different result. But when you look at what, in fact, is indicted, without regard to what the facts behind that are, the actual indictment, wouldn't that narrow your choices and then begin to allow a more purposeful comparison of the elements?
Absolutely. I think that would be a step in the right direction. The certified question that you presented for briefing in this case is not is not really based upon a Rance perspective. It's not saying let's compare the felony murder statute with the child endangering statute. This court asked us to compare specifically what the indictment language contained. Let's compare felony murder with child endangering as the predicate with child endangering. So this very question that you presented to us shows that Rance is really not the force and the premise for this analysis anymore. We're actually talking about what's the charge as indicted. We're moving to more a holistic approach, looking at what was indicted, what the actual charges in the specific case were, what the defendant's conduct is. So to the extent that that narrows it down, yes, I think that would be a step in the right direction. I have nothing further, Your Honors, unless you have any other questions. Except to say, I do think in this case, Mr. Johnson could be separately punished and deserves such. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Ms. Gutierrez, I know you had sought to reserve some time, and would you like 30 seconds?
Yes, please. Thank you,
Counsel, even if we were to go to the holistic conduct-based test, because of the fact pattern in this case, with the lengthy beating and then the final death, why wouldn't that be separate animus?
Your Honor, it would not be separate animus in this case because this court has dealt with this issue, you know, with the shots firing that you addressed in Williams. It's very similar to a bar fight case. And while the state...
But a bar fight case doesn't usually last all day.
Well, in this case, Your Honor, there actually is no evidence in the record that it lasted all day. What the evidence actually is in the case is that the mother was in the living room watching a movie with another child, heard a whomping noise is the word they use. She walks in, the child's on the ground. It's only several minutes later that she comes back in and the child's on the ground again. Obviously, at this point, he was close to death. And the argument is that it's a separate animus and only one single conviction and sentence in this case because it was a repeated beating. I don't think anyone can believe, especially when you read the testimony from the doctors in this case, that it was one hit, the child was down, it happened to be the next hit that caused the death. It's very difficult to determine that, and that was not determined in this case, that there was, you know, one failed blow. It was a repeated course of conduct and a repeated beating that caused the death in this case, and that's why it would be one single conviction and one single sentence. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.